This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
I'm David Remnick. The World Cup begins this week. But soccer in America is still a kind of acquired taste, and especially this year because our national team failed to qualify to compete for the most watched sporting event on the planet. We don't even get to compete. It's a real blow for fans, especially Roger Bennett. Bennett is kind of a rare bird. He's an Englishman who's devoted to American soccer. And he lives here while co-hosting the soccer podcast called Men in Blazers from NBC Sports. Bennett came to the studio to talk with Michael Luo about what's wrong with American soccer. Luo is a former captain of the Losser High School varsity team in Michigan. He's also, incidentally, the editor of NewYorker.com.
When I remember taking notice of you guys was during the 2014 World Cup when you somehow got a gig broadcasting from what seemed like a closet during the World Cup. And then after that, you got a show on NBC Sports Network.
You've just made it sound like the early scenes of Scarface. We arrived in America with nothing, and suddenly we're running a mid-sized
an
empire.
How did you, a British guy from Liverpool, a long-suffering fan of Everton, end up making a living basically riffing about soccer?
We were just beneficiaries of great timing, to be candid. I arrived in America in 1993. I loved America for the longest time. I actually grew up in Liverpool in the 80s, the greatest city in the world. But when I grew up, fairly dark economically, the Thatcher era, and I'd watch a steady stream of American television, heart to heart, Fantasy Island, The Love Boat, Charles in Charge, and each show, it just seemed like life was lived in Technicolor in America. And I always dreamed of moving there. And I moved there just when the World Cup came to America. And I watched the American team in 1994 swagger onto that field, ginger of beard, mulleted of hair. And I loved it. I just looked at these American guys and I thought, I love this. I love this country. I love this team. I love the possibility of the growth of the game here. And all I wanted to do was just dedicate my life to the growth of the game. I love soccer in the country. I love America.
So take us back to 1994 and what that point meant for American soccer.
So to understand 1994, the year that America hosted the World Cup, you have to understand what football was like before it. You know, when I drove in 1990, I drove around Maine. I was a college counselor, desperate to watch England in the semi-finals of the World Cup. Not a single bar was willing to pull the signal down on a huge satellite dish. They all wanted to watch the Portland Sea Dogs minor league baseball game. They looked at me like I was a madman. 94 changed all of that. The American team swaggered onto that field. They grabbed the world's attention. They got through the group stage. They played Brazil. They looked mighty Brazil, the eventual winners, in the eye on July 4th, no less, lost in a unbelievably brutal encounter. But that World Cup, it made America's pulse absolutely thicken around this sport. that the American players started to be coveted after that World Cup. They were the new heroes. They were on Wheaties boxes. You know, Letterman wanted them. NFL teams tried to recruit them to be kickers. Hollywood agents wanted them to star in movies. And European elite teams suddenly wanted the American, and they got jobs abroad. Alexi Lalas, he plays for a team in Padua. And in our podcast, American Fiasco, Eric Winalda tells the story of flying in after his Bundesliga game in Germany to pick up Alexi Lalas, who's played in the Serie A, scored a goal in a massive game. And Alexi says, let's go for dinner. And he goes, where are we going to go? He goes, well, there's a restaurant on a tiny island outside of Venice that's almost impossible to get into. We'll go there. And they get out on like a James Bond cigar boat. They just zoom out there and there's a huge line outside. There's no way they're getting in. And Lalas just pushes to the front of the line and the maitre d' is like, oh, Lalas is here. And just suddenly, like in Goodfellas, a table is whisked in out of nowhere, put down. They're given the pride of place. Suddenly, on a small stage, a spotlight goes on and everyone in this elite restaurant is clapping, saying, Lalas, please sing for us. And Alexi stops eating his pasta, strolls onto the stage and plays his latest cut from his album, Ginger. And Winalda says, I looked at it and he knew a year ago, Alexi Lalas was earning like a $5 a day per diem. And suddenly he's living a life which is a mixture of Mick Jagger and James Bond, plus Pelé kind of thrown into the mix. And that's how fast and how far soccer came.
So you have recently done a podcast about the 1998 World Cup in France, a series called American Fiasco, which I've been listening to. And that was a moment of profound disappointment for the American team. Talk about 1998 when the United States finished dead last, if you were to count goal differential in France, most embarrassingly losing to Iran. Remind us of what happened in 1998.
It was like if you've watched the movie Apocalypse Now, then you pretty well catch the last year of this campaign. I mean, the American mentality, Michael, is an amazing thing. One of the many reasons I love your country, which is about to become mine on Friday. I'm actually about to be sworn as an American citizen.
Congratulations.
God, it's genuinely the greatest thing I've ever done. But the American mentality is, we can do this. 90, we qualified, showed the world we could qualify. 94, we showed the world we can belong. What are we going to do in 1998? You know, we, the people who put a man on the moon, we, the people who put a Starbucks on every street corner, we're going to go and we're going to win the bloody World Cup. And what I was fascinated by was the series of decisions, many, many decisions, almost all of them awfully made, that along the way, one after another, combined to just turn a footballing culture that felt that nothing could stop it. And through human decision, one awful decision after another, and it was just became a march of folly. They didn't just destroy the US's World Cup campaign, they destroyed the sport's future. The stakes were so high, they needed the new league to grow. They needed to keep building on 94. You know, the sport lost a ton of sponsors. Americans turned away from soccer in droves. And it was really only the women, the US women, as so often, as please God they will next year, came in 1999 to save the day by winning the World Cup. And it took about a decade for the sport to really get back to where it was in terms of regaining the trust of the American public.
We can go World Cup by World Cup, but why don't we talk about obviously the most recent fiasco, America's failure to qualify for the World Cup. Did you have a feeling, deja vu a little bit? Are there parallels between the American fiasco in 1998 and this campaign?
The 2018 era where they needed to draw against Trinidad and Tobago, the worst team in qualifying. They failed to get one. We should never play two countries again at the same time. No more ands. Let's not get cocky, kid.
Yes.
Let's just play one country at a time. We'll be okay. 1998 was just one terrible decision in retrospect, taking each one, learning from the last mistake to kind of reinforce its cruelty and idiocy. 2018 has a similar trail of destruction that led to the failure in terms of the leadership. There was a massive leadership transformation. There was an arrogance amongst the players. There was a sense of entitlement. And what still remains the same from 1998 to 2018, and we still have not solved this problem, US soccer is remarkably unique and distinct in that it's an incredibly suburban sport still. I did a study with a Princeton academic, Greg Kaplan, before the last World Cup, where we studied the socioeconomic culture of every World Cup squad going back to 1990. And socially and economically, just off the radar, the US soccer player, their financial background, their levels of education, just the zip codes they came from, it's an incredibly suburban mentality. The American player, when they go to Europe, very often when you interview the players, they can't believe the level of cutthroat competition that exists and the level of accountability. The foreign players that come to the American League, they can't believe when you lose a big game. You know, talking to some of the massive players that have come, they'll say, I can't believe you lose a massive game, a derby here. And people are like, okay, cool, what are we playing next? And, you know, he said, when I played for Milan, if you lost, you did not show your face for a week and you trained with triple ferocity and you needed to get the press off your back. None of that accountability exists. There's something deeply parochial still at the heart of US soccer. And until we work it out how to eradicate that, it's always going to be a nearly sport from a professional perspective.
How big of a setback is this for US soccer?
2018, the US did not make the World Cup. It's devastating for the players. It's devastating for the fans. It's bad for human beings who love to have memories, great memories of Landon Donovan scoring against Algeria, of Jonathan Brooks, the young German-American who scored a late winner in the first goal game of the 2014 World Cup against Ghana.
Julian Green, the single best moment of his soccer life.
Good, Julian, good! So we will not have bona fide American memories, but the honest truth is the 2018 World Cup, it's not a matter of will Americans watch, will they not watch. The honest truth is the World Cup has become such a well-ingrained circus, a telenovela of heroes and villains and moments of human wonder and disaster and awful haircuts and ill-judged neck tattoos. And Americans, they love nothing more than a circus, Michael. They love an excuse to daytime drink. We always joke, if you're in a bar at 7:30 in the morning, you know, society frowns on that behavior. But if you're in that same bar and on the television, Russia are playing Saudi Arabia in the World Cup, you're a football fan. And for that reason, if no other, America will adore, will revere, will savor in the thing.
For our listeners who are maybe casual soccer fans, who should they be rooting for in this World Cup?
So you've got Iceland, this joyous little nation. Who truly believe Viking blood flows through their veins. So they're playing against Argentina in the first game. They think they're going to step onto that field and slay Argentina. I just love that self-confidence. You've got the greatest story in soccer, Ronaldo and Messi, the two for a decade just dueling greats. But if either one of them, Argentina, Messi, Portugal, Ronaldo, go deep in this tournament and win it, it will cement either man's legend as truly the greatest of all time.
I'll close with this reading from the back of your new book, Encyclopedia Blazer-Tanica. Soccer has been America's sport of the future since 1972, propelled by the rise of the World Cup, Premier League, the glory of the United States women's national team, Lionel Messi's demigoddess talent, and repeat exposure to Cristiano Ronaldo's pretty nabs. That future has finally arrived. When I read that, I was trying to figure out if you were joking or not. And after our conversation, I realized that you were being serious.
Yeah. If, below the age of 27, soccer is between the second and third biggest sport. When Americans are asked by the ESPN sports poll to name their favorite athlete in the world, Ronaldo and Messi are in the top 10. 72,000 fans will go and watch Atlanta play on a regular basis. All of which is to say, football, soccer, whatever you want to call it, is very much here. And it's why to call it America's sport of the future, as it has been since 1972, is such a warm delight for us, because we know that we're joking. It's very much here, Michael.
Roger Bennett is co-host of Men in Blazers. Bennett has just released American Fiasco, a particularly painful podcast from WNYC Studios about the epic U.S. fail in the 1998 World Cup. Michael Luo is the head of all of our digital platforms at The New Yorker.